What's up, everybody? Welcome back into another episode of Cult Film Cafe. Of course, it is me, one of your hosts, Jonathan, and as always, I'm joined by my partner in crime, Kenzie.
Hello there.
So, yay, we are now recording episode 22, I want to say, but it could be
it's 22, somewhere yeah. in that. I think it's 22, right?
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, we're making our way through the poster, and it's been great. It's just me and Kenzie on this episode, sadly, but we will have guests appearing very, very soon. And we might even have a wee in-studio session, which could be interesting. We could maybe work something out, maybe get it live, maybe do a live somewhere. Yeah, be interesting. So yeah, on this episode, we will be looking at Barton Fink, the 1991 period black comedy psychological thriller directed by the Coen brothers.
For the first time in the history of the Cannes Film Festival, one film has swept all the major awards. Barton Fink.
Welcome to Los Angeles, Mr. Fink.
Excuse me?
Howdy, neighbor.
Are you a writer, Mr. Fink?
Actually, I'm writing for the pictures now.
Oh, it's an exciting time, then.
Is that him? Is that Barton Fink?
Say whatever the hell you want. The writer is king here at Capitol Pictures. We're only interested in one thing. Can you tell a story, Bond? Can you make us laugh? Can you make us cry? Can you make us want to break out? Enjoy a song. Is that more than one thing? Okay.
Devil on the canvas, 12 apple, take one.
Just having trouble getting started.
Wallace Beery. Wrestling picture, what do you need, a roadmap?
We all need understanding, Barton.
Oh, you'll lick this picture business, believe me. You got a head on your shoulders. And what is it they say? Where there's a head, there's hope.
I'm sitting in the audience. The lights go down. Capitol logo comes up. Come on.
Nate?
LAPD.
Got some questions we want to ask you.
Sorry, I'm in trouble. Something horrible's happened.
A male Caucasian, about 30 years old. Ever seen Munt with anyone fits that description?
But, you know, with the head still on.
Well, Barton, you might say I saw peace of mind.
Right now, the contents of your head are the property of Capitol Pictures.
But Charlie, why me?
Because you don't listen!
I'm a writer.
A new film by Joel and Ethan Coen.
Now, I've never seen this film before. I mean, I'm not one of these people that reach out to try and watch every Coen Brothers movie, because I know there's people out there that are going to listen to this and go, oh, I'm a massive Coen Brothers fan. This film's like the best film in the world. We'll get to mine and Kenzie's actual opinions very soon, but this is a fucking strange movie.
Yeah. I honestly didn't know, like, I knew the title of this film, but that's all I knew about it. I just knew a film called Barton Fink. Had no idea what it was about. I had seen the poster for it somewhere before, but actually had no idea what it was. So we were going to it and saw it. I looked at the genre and it was like, yeah, black comedy, psychological thriller. I'm like, oh wait, what is this film? That's not what I was expecting. I don't know what I was expecting, mind you. So yeah, watching it, yeah, it's very weird.
Where do you start? This is a weird one. It's a bit of a strange one. It kind of opens. It's like a period drama, like what I mean, it's called a thriller. It's called fucking like every genre under the sun. Kind of opens normally, like it's a Coen Brothers movie. Obviously, you can tell straight away. There's a lot of weird shot choices in this, which I suppose maybe other directors wouldn't use. I think I noticed that one that kind of caught me was they had the camera on the floor when he was in the hotel room for one time. It was kind of strange. Like perspective, it's not like an angle, it's just it looked like it was like a flat trajectory, but you know, you could see the whole frame. Very, it's one of those things where it's not a shot that I've ever, not I have, obviously happens like in they won't be the only people to ever use like interesting shots, but it just kind of stood out. I just wasn't expecting it. And as a student and done film theory, it's not really a shot that we learn about. You know, you learn about close-ups and, you know, extreme close-ups, wide shots, establishing shots, mid shots, three-quarter shots, high angle, low angle, Dutch angle, which is a weird... Why are Dutch angle shots not really used in film all that much?
It's just a weird shot. I think it's because it's usually used for specific things, and it's used a lot in, well, horror. But even still, that nowadays, modern horror, for the most part, you don't see it as much. But certain films are starting to use it again. I see it quite a lot now, the kind of tilt.
But the canted angle.
Yeah, it adds a kind of weird, eerie, kind of horror-y feel to it. Usually when tensions are off and things are uneasy and you don't really know what's going on, you tend to get those angles.
Yeah.
It's a nice angle, I like it.
Well, a canted angle or a Dutch angle.
No, Dutch angle. Yeah.
It's the same thing.
I
can't eat in Dutch. It's the same. It's when the subjects is off the, so they're not like on the axis. It's kind of, it's like diagonal almost on screen.
Yeah.
Strange one. But I'm not saying, I don't even know if any of them appear in this. They probably don't. We were just talking a wee rift on shots and shot sizes and framing, etc. Anyway, this film stars John Turturro, John Goodman, Judy Davis, Michael Lerner, John Mahoney, John Polito. The film revolves around Barton Fink, played by John Turturro. Everybody listening will know who John Turturro is. I mean, if you're really young, what film will you know him from? Transformers is coming to mind.
The Batman.
What one?
The new one, but the Batman.
Oh, the Batman. Is he in the Batman? He's Falcon. In the Batman. No, he's Falcon.
He's also in Severance as well. In fact, I didn't know who he was until, but now recently I've seen him in quite a few things, and yeah, he is in Transformers too.
Pops up in a lot of things, but yeah, I mean, he's the lead in this. He's kind of a strange one. I should also point out there's a kind of cameo, sort of small role for Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, it's weird, eh?
I am Chet.
That's like, yeah, he's not.
I don't know if it's weird, it's just, it's strange. Because, in 91, he would have been in. What, this? When did Reservoir Dogs come out? 92.
92. This is early for Buscemi, I would say, I guess. But then, like, in later Coen Brothers films, he ends up in much bigger parts, of course, and stuff like that. It's not the weirdest part, I think, Buscemi's played. I think the weirdest part was Pulp Fiction. I'm pretty sure he plays a waiter. Like when John Travolta and Uma Thurman, like
Buddy Holly, waiter.
Yeah, you wouldn't even recognize him if you didn't know it was him. So yeah,
he was also in Miller's Crossing, which was the Coen Brothers film. Well, before this, but it's a bit of an interesting one because, as prefaced on the last episode, if you listen to this Sex, Lies, and Videotape, this is one of these scripts that I pulled out when I was riffing off scripts that were written in ridiculous amounts of time. I'm pretty sure this film was supposedly written in 3 to 4 days, as they were suffering from writer's block while trying to finish Miller's Crossing.
How do you write this, though?
Because the overarching theme is essentially a writer suffering from writer's block.
Well, that's true.
So you can understand why they decided to write this film. I don't know why they placed it in, well, this specific time period and stuff, like early 40s. He was a Broadway playwright who then goes to Hollywood to be a writer for Capitol Pictures.
Yeah.
Which is a strange one because I don't think he actually wanted to do it. But the film jumps from him being really successful with a play that he'd written, and then he's in Hollywood straight away. Like, because he did seem not willing to go.
Yeah.
But I think it was the lure of the money, by the sounds of it. But you can kind of tell he's not that type of person. And he really sticks out when he goes there.
It seems like he's kind of pushed into it almost. Well, not, I mean, yeah, I guess in the end it was his choice, but yeah, it's kind of weird. This film portrays Hollywood not very well. Like, it wants, it's taking like a, it's kind of stress, it's the whole kind of thing, it's like the horrors of Hollywood almost, making it see like what it's actually like. It's not very nice and whatnot, but it's a very weird film and how it does everything, how all the characters are in this film. There's no one who feels normal. Even Barton himself, who's for the most part is kind of the most normal, even he's weird as well. It's quite odd. Barton's got this fascination of telling stories about the working man. He always wants to be talking about the working man, even though he doesn't seem to really want to listen to the working man. It's like, as they show in certain parts of the film and stuff like that, and show his own hypocrisy and stuff like that. This film has like a lot, although not like a huge amount actually happens in the film for the most part. I think the film's trying to tackle a lot of different subjects, which is quite interesting, but I don't know if it does it very well. Well, I don't anyway. Should we?
Yeah, like the whole Hollywood stuff, I can understand that. Like, it's a capitalistic world and it's like money sort of is the root of all evil. Whereas being a playwright and maybe famous in New York, you can spend years writing a masterpiece, whereas quickly he's sort of thrown into this world where they expect him to produce films in a week, you know. And as much as I think it's baffling that film makers and writers can write scripts in such a short space of time, a la Sex, Lies and Videotape, and this and numerous other ones that I spoke about in the last episode, it's not the norm. It really isn't the norm. Like, I know that there'll be a lot of scripts, like, out there, and, like, but nuts and bolts and fleshing it out, that'll take time, like, probably. It's like, I mean, I don't really want to talk about it, but if you just look at how long it's took James Cameron to make Avatar, granted he was developing technology to make it, but yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure the scripts went through numerous rewrites in that amount of time also, you know.
I don't know, the new one was pretty
bad. I'm not saying the quality of writing's the same.
It felt like they scribbled it on a napkin and just fired it in, honestly.
But the problem is like, the Coen brothers are notoriously known for making films pretty quickly.
Yeah,
I mean, their first film came out in 1984, which was Blood Simple, and they released films, not together, separately in 2021, 2022, but all in, I think they've done around 20 movies in less than 40 years. So, I mean, that's one every 2 years, which for well-renowned filmmakers, that's quite a surprise, because if you look at other maybe well-known filmmakers, are maybe taking 3 to 5 years between films. Or you get the filmmakers that, case in point, since the Oscars has just not long happened, Todd Field, director of Tar, I think that was his first film in like 16 years.
Wow.
So, yeah. I mean, that might be a misquote, but I'm pretty sure the film before Tar came out in 2006.
What was it?
Well, look at you asking all the questions that people want to know the answer to. I've not seen it, but yeah, it's a filmmaker, Little Children. He made Little Children in 2006 and Tar in 2022.
So I'm not really familiar with that director, Todd Field.
Yeah, Little Children is the book. Like, it was a novel that came out. We wouldn't have read it, but yeah. He's also he's been an actor in film and TV, Todd Field, as well. Like, up until his kind of movie making career. But then again, does he need multi-million dollars to live off? Probably not. He's probably made like a few million from each film, and if you're just a smart person, you get to somehow basically make the films that you want to make, you know? I mean, he's received 6 Academy Award nominations, Todd Field. 2 for Best Picture, 2 for Best Adapted Screenplay, 1 for Best Director, 1 for Best Original Screenplay. So, I mean, he's a director. I think the reason we're not familiar with him, and like we've done an Oscar show, so we watched Tar. But it's clear to see that if you just watch Tar, he's a really good filmmaker, like really good. I mean, Tar was incredibly well made, but yet didn't really do anything at the Oscars, which is quite a surprise. And it's not the only surprise. There's a bunch of films that never done anything, and you would expect them to win at least one or two. But
Banshees.
Well, Banshees, my probably favourite film of 2022, done nothing at the Oscars, so just, it's a shock. I mean, I was shocked, and, you know, we've done an Oscars recap episode, which was out directly before this, and you can hear on that, I went in completely blind. Kenzie watched the awards ceremony. I had to go to sleep because I had to get up to go to work, but I just went in blind, and we kind of talked through our predictions, seeing if we got them right. And if we didn't get them right, I got like a second guess to see if I could get it. And yeah, there was some that were a big shock, some that were easy. I mean, Everything Everywhere All at Once totally just killed it. Winning, I think, 7 of their 11 nominations.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, you can't really compete with that. And I'm not saying it's a bad film. I really enjoyed Everything Everywhere All at Once. There's a couple of films I preferred over it. Anyway, I digress. Back to Barton Fink. This has got a really weird John Goodman performance.
It kind of starts with like John Goodman. John Goodman, for the most part, in a lot of his acting, portrays like a really nice kind of guy. That's what we kind of see John Goodman as a lot of the time. And this film, at first, you're not too sure. Like, Barton stays in a weird hotel. It's like kind of a place he stays while he's working on the script he's got to make for. He's making a boxing film, am I correct?
Yeah, he's a wrestling.
Wrestling, that was it. It was a wrestling film. And he's staying in like some hotel somewhere. But when he's in the hotel, he hears like laughing or something through the wall, so he calls Steve Buscemi, complains about it, which causes John Goodman to come out, knock on the door, opens up, and at first you don't know if he's good or bad. He's just kind of he's got that emotion that is on his face. There's just like no proper emotion to tell what he's actually feeling in that one moment, so you can't tell if he's going to be annoyed that Barton complained or if he's going to apologise or whatnot. But in the end, it turns out he actually apologises, and he seems quite nice. He seems very nice. He says he works as like a sales representative. Anyway, and he seems kind of rather nice, very kind of happy-go-lucky. He's very, very talkative. And it's much more expressive than what Barton Fink is. But then, like, as the film goes on, more comes out about John Goodman, and John Goodman's character ends up being, like, really weird. So it becomes... I've never seen John Goodman do a character like this before. But it's so odd. I mean, I've seen him be kind of villainous and stuff like that, but I don't exactly know what he is in this film at all. This film's like really kind of ambiguous, and I guess has a lot of symbolism. I guess I'm not honestly too sure. Like, I'm not sure if John Goodman is meant to be like a demon or what. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I mean, the character arc for John Goodman's character is a bit of a strange one. Yeah, he does seem just like a normal sort of everyday kind of guy at the start, and obviously that slowly but surely sort of descends deeper and deeper sort of into this, where it turns out he's not who he says he is. Like Charlie Meadows is who he names himself as, and obviously Barton Fink just believes him. I mean, why wouldn't you? But it turns out that later on in the film, he's actually Carl Madman Munt, who's a serial killer. Yeah, but those sort of keen-eyed people might have sort of seen signs in the film that he was a bad character. But I mean, I didn't see it like personally. I mean, I was asking myself what was going on, but there's reference to the wallpaper when it is sort of coming loose from the wall. I read somewhere that the whole thing is it only ever really happens when John Goodman's character has either been in the room or has just left the room, which is quite interesting. A bit of symbolism there.
That it's he's the same with the heat.
Be that sort of fiery, kind of hellish character, and that's the kind of the hotel's kind of fallen sort of under it. It's quite a strange one. It's quite weird. The thing about it is, for me, like early 90s John Goodman, to me, this character's a massive juxtaposition to the character that I vividly remember him being in the early 90s, which was Dan on Roseanne, the sitcom.
Yeah.
Where he's the dad, and he's just like, he's John Goodman, comedic actor and very sort of light-hearted and family friendly and stuff. Whereas this, complete opposite, he's pretty much evil to the bone, which we get there in a weird scene where he comes back to the hotel and the FBI are asking him to come out the elevator, and he comes out the elevator and everything starts to burn, and he just goes on a rampage with his shotgun. That's a strange scene. This is the thing, like the symbolisms, like you said earlier, this film feels like it's trying to tackle a lot of different subject matter and themes, and sort of maybe in a way where I don't necessarily think it's is easy to interpret, but then again, are films meant to be easy to interpret? Probably not. Like, you've got to make your own mind up with certain things. And for me personally, I just think it's too convoluted, this story, with so many different things. And it's hard to sort of find the true narrative. It's really, it kind of baffled me a wee bit, and like, obviously Barton Fink's the driver of the story, and I understand like the story arc there, and but even he's like not necessarily the most nice person. Like, I'm not saying he's a bad person, but he's not like a straight up nice guy. Like you preface, he doesn't listen to anybody. He's kind of in his own mind. He's self-centered. He worries about the wrong things. He basically ends up sleeping with John Mahoney's character, W.P. Mayhew's mistress or secretary, or I don't know, they aren't husband and wife, and that's a weird relationship as well. The Hollywood aspect of this, I get, like, that's the strongest theme for me, and obviously the easy theme of writer's block, because it was a direct sort of reference to what they were experiencing at the time. But apart from that, everything else just doesn't work for me.
I mean, I agree, to be honest. I don't even think the Hollywood part of it's that really good to me anyway. What does the John Goodman part have to do with like the rest of the film? It's like completely, from what I can tell, it just seems completely disassociated. That's what I'm not really understanding. They try to portray that Hollywood is hell, but John Goodman's not actually a part of the Hollywood thing. He's something completely different. But he lives in that hotel. What was his whole point? Because at the end of the film, all he seemed to say that all he said was that Barton Fink doesn't listen, which was portrayed over the film. There was actually quite a good part with when he's talking. Usually, what Barton Fink's always talking about is the working man. Oh, to what represent the working man? The working man. I've got all these stories, and then John Goodman, who's at that time, as you think, is just like a normal working man, goes, yeah. In fact, I can tell you a story right now, and Barton instantly interrupts him. It's like, see, that is the point exactly, and he just continues talking. Barton Fink's not very likable. And you soon kind of feel like he seems very up himself, and yeah, there's certain scenes that very portray that, like when he finally writes the script and he goes out dancing and he's celebrating about how what he's accomplished at like a kind of like a navy, was it like a navy or war kind of party thing for soldiers and stuff. I don't think they were going away because what time is it set at? Yeah, it's set in like the 40s. Early 40s, so it's like kind of like wartime. That's like one kind of good part, I guess. Like that you can see that, but like I don't know. Like I think my biggest issue with this film is it all just kind of goes over my head. Even understanding what most of the symbol that now like looking up and reading about what all of the symbolism stuff was kind of about or what it was somewhat saying, it still goes over my head. Like I just don't understand this film at all, and I just didn't really enjoy it. I just didn't like it. I felt kind of slow. Suddenly a woman's dead in his bed, suddenly John Goodman's a murderer, suddenly the hotel is on fire, and then he just goes into his house like, oh, I've eaten anymore. He's just like, has his whole speech to him. I mean, the performances are good, like both Johns, I just realised they're both called John, had great performances in this film, but like I don't know, man. I just don't really understand. The ending as well is so weird. What was in the box that John Goodman gave Barton? I don't know. I guess it was the head of the woman, but I don't know that. I'm thinking.
No, well, see, like the problem if you say that though, like if you say that it's the head of the woman, if that's what you think, then, and if it is true, it ruins one of my favorite all time films for me.
What, Seven?
Aye, because it's a direct riff. Like, what's in the box there is the head of his wife.
Yeah. What's in the box?
What's in the box?
Yeah, I don't actually know if that is what's in it, but it's so weird because he's like, hold on for this for a second, and then later on he's like, oh, yes, yours actually, and they did say that. Mad Munter or whatever his name is, they did say that what he does is he shoots someone with a shotgun and then decapitates someone, uses their keeps their heads as trophies. So what is that? I'm pretty sure it says it does.
Well, the problem is we're kind of stuck on this, the whole symbolism of the film. But the reason that it's so ambiguous is, one, there's loads of people that have written about this film and spoke about this film that have all got different sort of takeaways.
Yeah.
And two, although some people have suggested that it's the second half of the film is just a dream sequence. It kind of feels that way.
I mean, I guess it could be.
Like Barton Fink's becoming more and more withdrawn from the world that he's in. He's getting more and more unkempt. It's the only way to really understand why the hotel goes on fire. I mean, I don't think that would just happen in life. It doesn't. I mean, in reality, that wouldn't happen. But the thing is the Coens have also said that they find comfort in unresolved ambiguity. And that's fundamentally the problem. If the writers of the film are fine to write films that are ambiguous as fuck without any resolution, us as watchers and people that want to talk about the film or critique the film or write about it, we're also fucked.
I mean,
because we'll never know the answer. And that's fine, because as a person who loves open-ended narrative and leaving the audience to their own interpretation is fine to a point, but there's a big difference between a film that leaves an ambiguous part of the narrative and you can kind of piece together it. This seems to be loosely interconnected, but not enough for you to really understand what's going on.
Yeah. Like, ambiguity can be good if it's done right. I just don't think it's done very well here. I don't really know what... I said a lot of the things they're trying to portray or whatever they're trying to say, maybe they don't even fully know themselves, I guess. It's so odd. There's so many different... And they're doing with so many different things as well, which does not help, I feel like. Like, there's certain things that you completely forget about. Like, what was the mosquito about? Like, why did they keep him getting bit in the face by a mosquito for a bit, and then that just stopped happening? I don't know what that was saying. I'm still not entirely sure what the oozing, the white slime oozing out the walls. And then the ending as well, where it ends, and it's almost like he's in the painting. What's that supposed to show? Like, I saw someone online say that symbolized that he's actually had a psychotic break, possibly, or possibly. I don't know what. It's just...
Also, I want to pick up, so obviously we speak outside of the podcast, obviously. We were talking, and you were talking, like, we were talking about this film a bit, and you were talking about the homoerotic overtones.
Yeah, so I was watching.
Apparently, just before I let you pick it up, because it's something that you brought up and not me, apparently they're not unintentional.
It's so weird. I never saw this at all. I never got this. But one of the videos I watched about it after watching the film, yeah, they said the kind of homoerotic scene. I don't know, the shot they showed when they talked about that part there in the video was him having like the white slime on his hand, and I was like, what? So does that mean like the white? Is that supposed to like symbolize? Is that supposed to kind of be like semen or like what? I don't really know. There's also the thing that they wrestle at a certain part and stuff like that.
Well, just on really that, the wrestling scene,
the whole wrestling thing in general, I guess.
Apparently, Joel Cohen said in 2001 that they consider that a sex scene. Yeah, I think this is the problem with this film: is it's weird, wacky. They obviously needed a distraction from writing, in my opinion, a far superior movie a much better film to watch. If you've not watched Miller's Crossing, you definitely should. And this is by no means the Coen's best work. I mean, we've got a couple more films on the list of Coen brothers. I'm pretty sure I've said in the podcast that Tarantino is the lead director on this, but I think they're equal. We've both got three films on. We've got a couple more Coen brothers to do. I don't think we've tackled any of the Tarantino, but that's for another day. The two films that are to come from the Coen brothers are far superior, in my opinion, to this film. But that's just an opinion. I think that's the biggest problem, though. Like, we're beating around the bush, but this unresolved ambiguity of this film is the reason that we probably don't like it.
I guess.
I think if they maybe took two themes, three themes, like, you know, whatever, and just used them and sort of spread them out over the narrative, it would sort of maybe work. But there's two... It's people trying to be too clever for their own good sometimes, and when we get further into this podcast, we'll find out that this film is, people really love this film, but we'll get there eventually. And I'm still trying to figure out why, and I've got an opinion on this, which I might share later on in the podcast, unless I should share it now. I'm not sure. I'll probably save it for a bit, but we seem to have just focused on the symbolism and the themes of the movie. The plot, like you said, it's very straightforward. It's theatre writer Barton Fink gets a really glowing review, goes to Hollywood to become a writer on £1,000 a week or $1,000 a week or whatever the contract. I think his agent got it up to $2,000 a week to go and write pictures in Hollywood. And as soon as he gets there, he's like a fish out of water and he doesn't fit in. And he's doing everything he can to try and replicate New York because it was his choice to live in a rundown hotel. Like, they prefaced that they want him, like, Lipnick, the guy that's in charge of Capitol Pictures or a part of it. He's like, oh, let's move him to, like, the best of the best because he's coming with all this kind of buzz from the sort of stage shoot production he's just written and finished in New York. And it's even more alarming that it's like, because at the end of the film, Barton Fink is like, that he gives a script to Lipnick, he reads it, he says it's crap, but Barton Fink thinks it's the best thing he's ever written. But it just shows you the difference in styles. It's like, if he turned that into a stage production, it probably would be really good, but because he's not made what the guy that's sort of backing him and giving him all the money, that goes no further, and he's kind of stuck in this world that, I think that's another problem, is you've got this element where he's trapped as an artist, and as much as he's a dick and he doesn't listen to anybody else throughout the whole film, I mean, he even tries to get help from another writer, and that kind of goes wrong as well. That kind of leads to him finding out that Judy Davis's character, Audrey, yeah, she's actually been helping W.P. Mayhew write for a while, so it turns out that he's maybe not as much of a genius as Barton Fink thinks he is. So it's kind of like this whole kind of nature of, is the business kind of wrapped up in disguise, and who you think is really in, like a genius writer or producer or director or actor or whoever form of art that people do, is it all just fake? I think that's another message. See what I mean? Like, the more you analyse this film, the more you go down a path of, let's pick that one strand and see how far we can go with that. But you could do that probably 10 plus times in this film. And that's my biggest hang up with it, is it's just too much.
Yeah, it's too much for me. Like I said, and even understanding some of the stuff, I still feel like it's kind of going over my head and I don't really get much from it. Even knowing what they're trying to portray, I still don't really, it's just not for me. And then, yet people love it. People think some of the videos I've seen, some people were saying it was their favourite Coen Brothers film. What? Really? Oh, I don't know. I'm not gonna lie, I really didn't enjoy this film very much. I didn't have high expectations or anything for this film. I just kind of thought, okay, I'll watch this film, we'll see what it's like. And yeah, nah, just, this one just really isn't for me. Clearly it is for quite a lot of people, but, well, I see quite a lot, actually. I don't know if that's the case, but I don't know. I know the name of the film, but I don't know if it, is it that big? I don't know. Well, it's clearly got a fan base anyway. So yeah.
What I prefaced about, you pick a strand, see how far you can go down with that theme. That's a crux for me in this film. I wish there was just maybe stronger themes. And they are there, and it's easy to see that they're there, but I think it becomes convoluted. That's one of my gripes. Two, this film doesn't know what genre a film it wants to be.
It doesn't.
Like, there's so many kind of, I don't know what the word would be, sort of homages to things. Like, the shots of the interior corridors in the hotel is a riff off Stanley Kubrick in The Shining. It's complete, like, homage to that. But that's a horror movie. But the thing is the Jack Torrance character is a writer. Barton Fink is a writer. They're both suffering from writer's block. They both go insane in their own way. Am I just am I? Do you not see the similarities?
I see that. Yeah.
It's kind of it's strange, and there's more films that they've kind of, and there's nothing wrong with that. Filmmakers of a bygone era should be referenced. They should be given a homage to, because it's the reason that cinema is as good as it is and as compelling as it is. But when you try and put too much in, that's where it kind of becomes really difficult. You know, the thing about it is I don't dislike this film. I just don't think it's their best work. The plus points of this film for me are acting is really good, like really, really good, specifically from John Turturro, who is probably quite underrated in sort of more common circles. Obviously, people that watch film and critique film and talk about film, they'll know him and know that he's a great character actor. And John Goodman in this is phenomenally good, because it's such a different kind of performance to what I would assume he would be doing at this point, considering other choices he was probably making. But then again, a character like that gives him the sort of weirdness to go out and sort of portray something a bit different. And all the other performances, they're all kind of like, this is set in Hollywood, that's all over the top. Everybody seems to be over the top, apart from Barton Fink, because he's kind of coming into this world, and that's great. Second of all, I love the way that this is shot. This film looks great, it was shot great, and that's no surprise, because this is the first time that the Coen brothers collaborated with the wonderfully talented and great cinematographer Roger Deakins, which is a weird one, because Roger Deakins, like they were, the first three Coen brothers movies were shot by Barry Sonnenfeld, who was making his directorial debut, so he couldn't shoot this film for them. They liked Roger Deakins' work, and but Roger Deakins' agent, this is another one of these stories, Roger Deakins' agent told them not to work with the Coen brothers. He met in a cafe in Notting Hill and started to work with them, and I think he's collaborated now on something like 12 movies with them.
Hmm.
So that's maybe why the Coen brothers films look as good as they do. It's maybe not that difficult to see why. They all look the way they do in are well shot movies, because he's worked on all of their big films essentially, you know, and their best film, which is probably No Country. I think we both agree.
I think it's hands down, really. I don't think it's not even a controversial opinion, I don't think.
Meh, it might be for some, you know. I think it's what we would assume.
I think it's probably the status quo for most people, I would agree.
Might be. I mean, Roger Deakins is a legend in the game, but he's also known for, you know, working with Denis Villeneuve, Prisoners, Sicario, Blade Runner 2049, which is an incredible looking film, won an Academy Award. Taken him a long time to get the nod from the Academy, but he then won two back-to-back, because he quickly followed up 2049 with 1917, which, phenomenally shot movie, just don't necessarily think it's going to be one of those films that are referenced in 50 years, maybe like a Saving Private Ryan, but that's for another discussion. Anyway, I think we've spoke enough about this film, what we like, what we dislike. I think it's clear to see that Kenzie doesn't really like this film. I'm a bit middling in it. I can see some of the good, I can see some of the bad, which is funny, because I think there's a lot of people out there that see no bad, and maybe we're just reading it differently from everybody else. But yeah, do you want to just finish up this section and give the ratings?
Yeah, I think I've talked about this for quite a while. I don't think I really want to say any more about it.
Right, I'll go first, because I think we were speaking and you were unsure what you were going to give it, so I'll let you kind of sit back and have a think.
Okay.
I like this film, but I don't love it, and I think that's the problem. I think there's loads of people out there that will probably love this film, and that's why it's some people's favourite Coen brothers movie, some people's favourite movie, maybe, you know. I just can't get there. Like I've just said, love the acting, love the way this is shot. Roger Deakins is phenomenal. The Coen brothers are phenomenal. I just, it's the symbolism and the subject matter and the sort of ambiguity around the narrative and the themes. It's just, it kind of fried my brain a wee bit, and it was quite a difficult watch at times, even though it's not that long. It kind of dragged because the film really only kind of happens in the hotel and whenever he's going to the studio. And that's, if you watch films now, there's films that have got multiple locations and it kind of catches your eye. This one, strange, but then I suppose that's maybe part of making things look the way they do, is because you're in such a confined space. So maybe that's why I like the way that it's shot, because they're using the space and the sort of different angles and camera sort of shots, and that's probably why it works for me, and the acting. So I'm going to give it a 3 out of 5, I think. I almost got to 3.5. Subject to change, though. It could get to 3.5, but I'm going to stick with a 3 at the moment.
I don't like this film. I just don't. Like, it's I don't know. It's not an enjoy. I did not enjoy watching this. I will probably not watch this film ever again, and I wouldn't mind not watching this film again, because it's just, I didn't enjoy, it wasn't an enjoyable watch for me. I watched through it, I was paying attention, I didn't like lose attention at any part, but it was just kind of, I don't know, it felt kind of nothing to me, a lot of this film. Like, a lot of the symbolism went kind of over my head, and even understanding it, I still don't fully get it. It's kind of what, I don't know. The story goes from nothing really happening to suddenly nothing's really happening, so suddenly everything goes off the rails that near the end, like as it goes along. But it's, and then that ending, I just the ending is the weirdest part to me. It just suddenly ends, and it just ends like this weird thing that I do not have a clue what that means at all. It just does not make any sense to me. It suddenly goes from one scene where he's talking about, it goes from the scene where he's told that his script, the guy doesn't like his script. It literally goes from that to the final part where he's in, like, the painting. I don't know. I don't get it. Like, Coen brothers are great. I like a lot of their films from the ones I've seen. In fact, this is probably the first Coen brothers film I've watched that I've not actually liked. But, yeah, this one's not for me. I wouldn't really, I don't know if I'd recommend this. Like, I don't know. If you're a fan of the Coen brothers, maybe watch it. That's all I could really say, but, like, and depends how much you like symbolism and stuff like that. But I know if you're looking for, like, a straightforward, like, just kind of narrative film, this is not going to be the one for you. And it wasn't for me. But it clearly has fans, so, and it's quite highly rated, so I'm probably in the minority. So, I just don't like it. It's not enjoyable to me at all, really. But it's not terrible, because the performances are good, and it's shot well, and you do kind of, even with the kinematic, you kind of do get it. Like, I can see somewhat what they were trying to do, but I don't know. It just didn't work for me. It was a bit too weird, a bit too wacky. I would give it a 2.
Yeah, I thought that's what you were going to boil down to, a 2. I mean, we don't really give sort of ones or 1.5s really all that much on the podcast. I think the lowest we really go in the main series is a 2. I mean, I might have given a 1 here or there because I'm just a dick, but yeah. So, I mean, I'm a bit more favourable, so giving it a 3. Kenzie's obviously a bit less favourable, giving it a 2. But that is it for the ratings. Now let's move on to the real section of the podcast, and kicking this one off with low budget stroke box office flop. Now, it's one of these where it's a strange one. The film was produced on a budget of $9 million.
Yes.
it grossed just around 6.2 million.
Yeah.
And in 2023, that would be a budget of just shy of 20 million and a total box office gross of just over 13.5. It's a bit of a strange one, because this is the thing about the Coen brothers. I think I've always moaned about this kind of space in film where the sort of mid-tier movies are made. Like, so it's not like super low budget and it's not like $100 million budget. And I feel like this is a space that the Coen brothers work in like all the time. I think the most amount of money they've ever spent making a film is $60 million, and that was Intolerable Cruelty. And that probably cost that amount of money because George Clooney and Catherine Zeta-Jones was in it. It wouldn't surprise me if George Clooney got paid north of $20 million just for his role in the movie, because he was like one of the biggest actors at the time. So, yeah, you factor that in, it's not all that expensive of a film, even though it was made in the early 2000s. This one, I mean, 9 million early 90s, so it's about 20 million now. It's a weird one. I don't necessarily think it qualifies as low budget. I think anything under like 10, if it's under 10 now, which means it'll be way lower than that back when it was made, is probably a safe space to call it a low budget film. So this is a strange one, but it flopped. It was a flop. Let's just like make no bones about it. It
flopped like a fish.
Yeah, it should have. If to break even, it probably needed to make about 20 to 25, and then obviously to start generating money north of that. But the problem with this film is even though it was a flop, it's so well respected in the industry. It's a strange one. Like, this film, it won the Palme d'Or, Best Director and Best Actor. And this is us just coming off of episode where I was speaking about Cannes and how much Sex, Lies and Videotape sort of changed the industry for me. Kenzie obviously didn't agree, but that's why we both have our own opinions on matters like that. But, I mean, yeah, Coen brothers were making films before Steven Soderbergh, you know, the 1984, 1987, 1991. I mean, they'd done a couple of films before Soderbergh kind of sort of rocked up. But I think kind of films like this just started to change the sort of landscape a wee bit, you know? And kind of showing you what was sort of like there, like in a kind of more broad spectrum of the film industry. I mean, it didn't have to be like big blockbusters all the time or really, really small indie films. You could have this kind of middling ground where I feel as though the film industry kind of had in the 90s and maybe early 2000s, which is, like I've said many times, it's just disappeared.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I don't know what fully has killed the middle budget. Some people say that streaming was not a very good help for it, I guess. I don't know if that's the case. So I saw this video talking about Knives Out, saying how Knives Out was going to save the middle and budget film, because it had a kind of Knives Out had a bit of middle. They said had a middle and budget, done very well, and they're like, yeah, this is a film that's going to cause more films in that price range to come out. But then all of a sudden, Netflix buys them, and that now everyone's like, oh well, now it's killed it. I don't know.
Like, no, well, not only did Netflix buy them, Netflix bought the rights to two films for like $450 million.
Yeah. It's only two films.
Not like five. You can't be like Knives Out. Fair enough, the first Knives Out film was like a middling budget and it done well and it was critically acclaimed. But you can't then turn around and be like, this is a franchise that's going to save the middling budget movie when soon as Netflix come in and go, here's a fuck ton of cash, you know? And to be honest with you, what they've done with that fuck ton of cash is made a worse film, in my opinion. Like, I don't think throwing money at good concepts, which Knives Out is a great concept, Benoit Blanc as a character is great, Daniel Craig's great, Rian Johnson's great. I'm a massive Rian Johnson fan. I'm one of those people that was a defender of him when there was backlash because of The Last Jedi. I mean, I don't think it was fair for him to take all the flack for it. And actually, that film's critically acclaimed, The Last Jedi. It's just not very well received by the audience. But Star Wars fans can go and suck a big dick, in my opinion. Like, just be happy that they're still making the films that you want to go and fucking see. Because they don't have to. They really don't. Do you know what I mean? And if you genuinely have that big an opinion where they're shit, stop going to fucking watch them and giving them billions of dollars. That's a hot take, and I've just came at Star Wars fans, and I'm sorry about that. But it happens across the creative industries where folk moan about artistic output. But if you're going to moan about it, fucking go and do your own shit. You should just be happy that people are making films that, even if they're subpar to the standards that were set 40 years ago, that they're still actually entertaining. I mean, they don't have to do it. I mean, it is a money business and it's a big IP, but at the end of the day, and also the biggest problem I've got is the fans of the film that were shooting shade at Rian Johnson, have they watched anything else that he's made? Because every single time he's in total control of a production, from the writing aspect to the directing aspect to the way it looks, they're all fantastic. He's not made a bad film. Like, Brick is easily one of the best modern noir movies ever. I love it. Looper is probably my favourite, if not the kind of most easy to understand time travel movie that's ever been made. He's not a bad movie maker. Why did he take all the flack for it? Sorry, I'm off on a mad rant.
I can't speak for
also, it. Also, safe to say that I'm not a Star Wars fan just with that rant. Sorry, but at the end of the day, I like ingenious and original filmmakers, so that's why I defend them to the hilt, because they should be given a platform to just be creative as fuck. And if Netflix is that platform, so be it. I don't think it's right it's not right. It doesn't make things better by throwing loads of money into it. That's my point there. Sorry I went on a mad tangent, but that was my whole point, is throwing loads of money at somebody doesn't always work. I mean, there's another example, actually, another example is Robert Eggers. Or Eggers, I don't know how you pronounce his last name. Eggers, is it Eggers?
I actually don't know.
Anyway.
I think it is Eggers.
He's been lauded as this next up-and-coming kind of sort of eerie horror movie maker, and done The Witch, done The Lighthouse, and then they went, here's a boatload of cash. And he made a film which I actually really liked. I think it looks fantastic. The performances are fantastic. And he's stepped up. The gulf that he stepped up is massive. He went from making a $10 to $50 million movie to making a $80 million movie. That's a massive jump. And folk will go, it's not that good. It's like, well. And I think you should maybe talk about the other one who's just bombed massively and, you know. Even though you want to go and see the film.
What, Babylon?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's horrifically bummed. I don't know if it's good. I mean, I feel like I might like it, but I was just interested. I think it looked good.
Do you think it's fair, though, that all these people that come out, you know, the wee keyboard warriors that go, oh, Damien Chazelle's finished, he'll never make another movie ever again?
I mean, I think that type of take is bad. I think it's fine to criticise. If you really don't like it, then you really don't like it. You can say what you want, I guess. Sometimes you can be overly harsh, but that's always film's opinion. I feel like saying, when you say, oh, they shouldn't make a film ever again.
To work again.
Yeah, that's harsh, and that's like, because that's actually someone's job and livelihood.
Well, that's my defense.
That's more of an attack than anything, I would
that's
say.
That's why I defend my Rian Johnson take, because that's what happened to him with The Last Jedi.
Yeah, it's, I think that's a poor thing to say. Babylon. Like films are hard to make. It's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing to direct. It's not an easy thing to say that, they should never do it again. And it's like,
what
gives you
the
right to say that compared to other people?
It's like, that's my thing. Have you tried to make a movie? Have you went out and tried to write a movie? Have you tried to turn it into something that's visual? I mean, I have. It's fucking hard. And sometimes you've got to put your nuts on the table and folk watch it and go, that's shit. But at the end of the day, like, there's an audience for everything. You've just got to find it. And like, but the problem is with the internet and social media and things like Twitter and all sorts of other sort of sites that you can go on and log an anonymous like take on things, it's when it reflects somebody's livelihood, it starts to just become a bit dickish, you know. Like we both, like, hot take, if in 1991, 92, and if we were doing a podcast way before podcasting, say we went back in time and started it, or a hot take in Barton Fink, this is shit, Coen Brothers should never get any more money to make a film ever again. That's all they shite, because look what they went on and made.
Look what they've made. Yeah, exactly.
And also, for people that think Damien Chazelle should not make another movie, fucking watch Whiplash again.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't give a fuck. Yeah. Like, just watch it again and see how good that fucking film is.
That's true. I mean, if he could pull another Whiplash, I think that shows you what he can do. And like, yeah, people are always going to take missteps. That's what always happens.
I don't want to pass judgment in films that I haven't seen, but speaking to people about Jordan Peele's Nope, I need to watch it. I will get around to it. I quite like Jordan Peele. But the thing is I think people have had like a kind of step back reaction. I think there's loads of people out there that love it. There's people out there that probably really don't like it because it's this kind of weird sci-fi kind of thrillery, horror-y kind of vibe that Jordan Peele does. But my point is that if I go in and watch it and I don't like it, I just go and watch Get Out again and be like, ah, fuck, he's great. You know, it's like...
Get Out slaps. Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Like, he's already made that film, so he's got time, you know? It's the same with Damien Chazelle. Damien Chazelle's like, what, not even 40? Like, he's in his mid to late 30s and people are already telling him, saying that they shouldn't get money again or shouldn't be able to make another movie. So what? Like, his fourth movie, he took a big fucking swing. At least he took a swing. That's what I can say. Yeah, anyway. We were on low-budget show, box low budget. Flop.
So it was a flop. Budget, I would still say it's kind of low, but, like, I guess you are right. It's, if you judge it by, like, nowadays, it is kind of getting to low-middling. But mix it with the flop, it ticks it, really, doesn't it? Because it flopped pretty hard.
Aye, but I mean, like, what films were getting made in 1991? Let's have a wee look, right? So, I mean, how much did... That's 35 million, I suppose. What was the budget for this? Nine. Oof. I mean, you've got films... I'm trying to find a film that made loads of money. Oh, right, there you go. So, Silence of the Lambs was Jonathan Demme's film, 1991. So the budget in that film was 10 million more, 19 million, but it made $272 million and was the fifth highest grossing film of the year. That's the thing. Like, I don't think, I think the most expensive film in 1991 was probably Terminator 2, which had a $100 million budget, but also made $500 million. See, that's the thing. You've got to put it in comparison, like, they weren't making $100 million movies. Yeah, I get your point. It probably is kind of in a weird space in terms of budget for low budget, but because it flopped so hard, it's an easy tick for this one.
Yeah, I agree.
We will now be moving on to rewatchability. Now, this is a hard pass for me. I mean, the film's just shy of 2 hours clocking in it. 116 minutes.
It's not rewatchable for me either.
Maybe for some people. It's so slow.
It is slow. It is. And, like, it starts to speed up a bit at the end, but even still, it's not an easy watch. I think for some people who really like everything about this film, maybe it is. But even still, I don't know. I feel like you're going to watch it. I don't think you're going to go and just watch it again. I feel like it's. Unless you want. I mean. I guess you could give it a second watch to see things you probably missed before and stuff like that. That is very true. But for me, it really isn't. I didn't enjoy it. I just don't think it's a good film to rewatch. It is quite slow, and you feel it. It's not that nice 90-minute mark. Oh, Sometimes I watch, so when I watch long films, sometimes I forget that some films can be short, and it makes me, when I watch a short film again, it's like, you know, that's good. And I quite like, to be honest, I do actually quite like long films, yeah. I like slow burns, that's the thing, I like slow things quite a lot, but this, sometimes I really can't hack it with certain films, and this film wasn't the hardest, but it wasn't great for me for watching it, pacing wise. Not a big fan, and I wouldn't really say it's rewatchable.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. It's probably a film that I'm not going to say I'll never ever revisit, but it's not at the top of a list of films that I'm going to be rewatching. I mean, there's films that we've done recently that I'll watch over it, and like I don't hate a long film. It's just depends what film it is. I'm quite happy to watch a 2 hour, 3 hour movie, 2.5, 3 hour movie, but I mean, not this particular one. I just wanted to preface as well that when I said earlier on in the podcast that they wrote this film in 3 to 4 days, that's a lie. It took them 3 weeks, but then nevertheless, it's still 3 weeks to write a film. Not rewatchable. I think we both agree with that. It's not necessarily a length thing. I think it's just the film in general for us.
Yeah. I think maybe for some people who do like the film more, that they could be rewatchable. But even still, I don't see them watching a lot. You know what I mean? Because it's not that type of film. More talk about it than watch it again. Maybe.
Yeah. Anyway, that is it for rewatchability. We're moving on to quotability.
Yeah, I can't. I don't think so.
Nah.
I don't think so. Again, it's one of these things. It's written well, dialogue wise, the dialogue and all in this film is good, and there's some good monologues in the film from most of the characters to give good dialogue, but it's nothing that catches the eye to quote. Not like really, because usually with quotability, it's our kind of cheesy stuff. This film does not have that. Or it's like a really, really, really good quote. I just don't think it has that either. It just kind of has good dialogue, and that's really it. I don't see anyone quoting Barton Fink ever. Even fans, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that. It's just... There might be some... It's hard. I think John Goodman has probably got a couple of the one-liners that you might hear. But I do agree with you that it's just like Sex, Lies and Videotape. It's just a really well-written film. But then again, there'll be some people out there that'll be like, no, you're wrong, like there's loads.
Yeah, possibly. I feel like maybe on like something like Jordan Goodman's like "You Never Listen," maybe that could be quoted. I guess I don't know. It just doesn't really seem like it's very quotable to me. But some people might disagree with me on that, and that's fair. Might have some Barton Fink fans be like, "Yo, what about this one?" I'm like, okay.
But for me, the biggest one for me that kind of got me I googled it after like watching it, is at the end of the film. When John Goodman's reciting the same thing, "Look upon me, I'll show you the life of the mind."
There's a boy, man. Put the policy case down and your mitts in the air.
Bye!
that, what does that mean? I still don't understand what that means.
I don't know why he says that, because why is he the life of the mind?
I'm not sure. See, this is the problem, is like...
I thought Barton would have been that, not
yeah,
him. But
possibly.
I don't know what he is, that's the thing, so, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Like the more I look at some of the quotes on it, the more I'm like, maybe there is. I think poignant for me would be Barton saying, "I've always found that writing comes from a great inner pain," which I feel like writing in general, like as part of that artistic expression, that I think just listen to some music as well. It seems to be, it's a lot of moments of heartache, or you know, that basically people write about, that becomes the best songs or the best books. You know, it's not a hot take to understand that, and writing it in a script, plaudits to the Coen brothers for doing it. I think they kind of caught the sort of the feeling right. I mean, like you said, incredibly well written film, and there probably is massive fans of this film that probably do think it's quotable, but like I said, like Kenzie said, there's not the kind of one liner, the one or two in it, you know, that make it a given for this. So I'm quite happy to say that it isn't quotable. I just wanted to say, though, quickly before we move on, that the tagline for this film is my favourite thing. Like, in terms of, it's not a quote, but it's like a kind of tagline for the movie. And it's "Between heaven and hell, there's always Hollywood." It seems to be the kind of ethos of one of the sort of themes of the film is Hollywood's kind of this not nice place. And actually, when you look at the kind of the landscape of it now, or like what's kind of came to light over the last 5 to 10 years, you can understand why it's kind of viewed that way.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's not digress. Let's move on to not well received by contemporary critics / reviewers. Now, this is where we are so far away from, like, most
everyone.
People's consensus of this. Like, on Rotten Tomatoes, the film has an 89% fresh rating based on 65 reviews. It's got an 89% audience score based on over 25,000 logs from people that watched the film. But the neck and neck, it's quite rare for a film to be exactly the same. And if you're putting it, it's nearly 90%, which would make it a 4.5-star movie if you averaged it out, which we are so far away from that in our own opinions of it. On IMDb, the film has a 7.6 out of 10 based on 120-plus ratings. Legendary film critic Roger Ebert gave the film 3.5 out of 4. Philip Thomas for Empire Magazine gave the film 4 out of 5. So they're right up there, maybe not exactly in line with Rotten Tomatoes and the sort of audience consensus, but still there or thereabouts. We are much lower.
Yeah.
And it's probably the reason why this film's talked about so much. It's because it's like, it's lauded as one of these amazing films. It's quite hard to get a film close or pretty much in the 90%, you know, when you think about it. It's a tough one. It's also got a 69% Metacritic, which is almost 7 out of 10, which kind of, that's also baffling. They're really quite hard. They're really quite harsh when it comes to kind of grading films. So I don't quite get it. Like, that's what I don't quite understand is why it's so well received.
I don't get it at all. I can understand people liking it, fair, but like how like the common consensus is that it's really good. That shocks me, because it doesn't seem like the type of film that would be like that.
Yeah, audiences of the film polled by CinemaScore gave the film an average grade of B. They grade films from an A+ to an F. That's kind of strange as well, because you still have like an A-, an A and an A+. So I don't feel like I'm a million miles away if I was grading it based on like A+, A-, B. I would maybe give this film like a B-. I don't think I'm miles away from there. I just think some of them are, there's so much overly positive about this. I'm quite glad that there's some critics that disliked it. And the ambiguous ending, I think the ambiguity of the film is you either love it or hate it. This is the kind of crux of it. Jonathan Rosenbaum for the Chicago Reader, he gave it a negative review. John Simon from the National Review also described Barton Fink as asinine and insufferable. So there is people that dislike it. There's probably people out there that dislike it more than us.
Yeah.
But then again, you get like screenwriters. I think this is one of these kind of meta films that like screenwriters are probably like, oh, I fucking love this because there's like so much uncertainty and it's so cool. Like Charlie Kaufman, he was asked what film he would want on a desert island, and he said that he really loves Barton Fink. He says he didn't know if he would take it, but he says you could watch it again and again. I fucking violently disagree with that.
Yeah.
IndieWire has also ranked this as the fifth best Coen Brothers film. We're not ranking. We might do it on the podcast in the future, ranking episodes of directors. The Coen Brothers would be an interesting one. I'm not sure I would have this in my top five, though. Just off
right
the,
now, it's
off
my
the
least. It's at the bottom for me, from the ones I've seen.
Right, you've not seen all 20 not films. But so. Anyway, that's a no.
It is
highly well received across the board. Obviously, like most things, there is some negativity out there, but from the most part, highly positive. So we move on to expose controversial topics, subjects, and themes. I think we should just preface that if you've tuned into the episode of the podcast here, why? And if you have done, please go back to the start, because we spent a lot of time at the start when we just speak about the film, talking about this part of it. The whole point of this being exposed controversial topics, subjects and themes, because we tackle cult movies here on the podcast. Well, we're tackling a poster of cult movies. Things for me, when I was developing the idea, there's a lot of cult films out there that take the hard edged approach and go, I want to really explore a subject matter which is so out there that it's going to shock people, a la Man Bites Dog, a couple episodes ago. That's why, like, not only is it like a fucking really small independent foreign European film, it's fucking out there. This is out there, but it's not out there in the controversy stakes for me. I mean, I think they're kind of the hottest take might be the way that they're exploring Hollywood, even though that they are suckling from the teat of Hollywood. Where do they get their money to make fucking films? From Hollywood. So it's a bit funny that they should fucking call it out. I've heard people's takes about this being symbolising like the rise of Nazism in Germany in the early 30s, and I'm like, what the fuck? Like, there's been takes about slavery as well, which is a hot take if you're going to do a film and talk about slavery. That's a controversial subject. But I don't think, because Barton Fink's basically locked into a contract for X amount of years making $2,000 a week, which is probably quite a lot of money in 1941. I don't think I would call that slavery, would you?
No,
I'd quite like somebody to pay me $2,000 a week currently.
Yeah, it's.
I can understand why people think it's slavery. Obviously, how is he getting out of his contract? He signed a contract. That's the way the world works. Do I agree with it? No, but don't sign contracts.
There's so many topics and themes in this, and some can be maybe slightly cut short. What's kind of funny is I was just scanning through the Wikipedia page. This is one of the longest Wikipedia pages I've seen for a film in my life. It's crazy. For a film I had never heard about, it's got a huge Wikipedia page. Whoever wrote this just went all out and just put tons of stuff in it. But, like, yeah, I mean, it kind of slightly is controversial, but it's not, like, the most kind of controversial thing. I think this is most of its symbolism, and it's not, like, too hard. It's not hard to watch, if you know what I mean? There's a bit of violence, not that bad. You've seen way worse than anything else, pretty much. I completely agree with Jonathan, and I actually was going to say the exact same thing. As the most controversial thing is the way they look at Hollywood. Because I guess that's it. Everything else is kind of... What? I don't know.
I mean, I don't think it's actually that controversial to look at Hollywood that way, because, I mean, look at what's happened over the last number of years. It seems like it's that type of place, and the people are so wrapped up in that world that it's hard to be not associated, or, you know, you could become very disassociated with real life and reality. Like, and that obviously happens for people. But I just think it's quite a weird take for filmmakers that basically get funded money to make movies to then have a pop at the kind of system that they work in. But then again, who else, if not people that work in the industry, to do it? Yeah, interesting, but I wouldn't necessarily call this controversial, really.
It's like a slight tinge. It's like in the middle, I would say. It's not like fully controversial, but I don't think it's exactly completely not controversial at all. It's just kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of them. Anyway, so that is it. And like I said at the start of this rule, if you are tuning in now, go back to the start. We speak a lot about the sort of subject matter and topics and themes of this film. Last but not least is cultural impact and legacy. Now, I'm just going to read what I've got written for this. It's not very long. My input for this is me being a dick, because it's like me, but I've just wrote, just being a Coen Brothers film, this must have some impact and legacy, but I'm just not sure how much. Unlike the last episode on Sex, Lies and Videotape, where I felt that it had a huge impact on the landscape of future cinema, this film just feels like a project they undertook to help them produce a far and away superior film in Miller's Crossing. But this is my slight on the Coen Brothers. It's not my favourite Coen Brothers film, but I feel as though every Coen Brothers film has an impact and a legacy because it's a Coen Brothers film. And it's like, is that just the way that people should be taken? Just at face value like that? And I feel like inherently, like every time the Coen Brothers release a movie, they're massively critically acclaimed. I don't think if you look at their Rotten Tomatoes score for all their films that any of them have been absolute bombs.
No, I don't think so.
Which seems a bit bizarre. Make 20 movies and you've never made a bad one. That seems a bit fishy to me.
I don't know. I mean, I they are good writers. Like, you cannot deny that. But I don't know. I mean, definitely, quite a few of the films have been very. I have had a huge cultural impact, but I don't think all of them have. Especially some of the more recent ones. I guess they're not enough times passed, maybe. But like something like Buster Scruggs that I do like a lot. I don't think it has like as much of a cultural impact. I think this film didn't really have an impact, to be honest, because I hardly knew this film ever exists. I knew the name of the film. That's all I knew about it. If I go up to like, I bet if I walked about and asked people, "Oh, do you know what Barton Fink is?" They wouldn't know. So that's kind of interesting.
Like it's like films that they've directed, right? Like Rotten Tomatoes, right? These are the Rotten Tomatoes scores. Like Blood Simple, 93%. Raising Arizona, 90%. Miller's Crossing, 93%. Barton Fink, 89%. The Hudsucker Proxy, 60%. So we've dipped there. Fargo, 94%. Big Lebowski, 79%. Old Brother, Where Art Thou, 79%. Down from the Mountain, I mean, I think that was like a documentary. 97% but then we've got The Man Who Wasn't There, 81%, Intolerable Cruelty, 75%. It's just, it goes on and on. Lady Killers, there we go, we finally get one, 54%. But then again, you've got No Country, 93%, Burn After Reading, 78%, Serious Man, 89%, True Grit, 95%. Inside Llewyn Davis, 92%, is a film I absolutely love, which is maybe a slept on Coen Brothers movie, but it is a really good film. Hail Caesar, 86%. Ballad of Buster Scruggs, 89%. And then Joel Coen done The Tragedy of Macbeth, which came out in 2021, 92%. It's just, I just feel as though they've done one bad film.
One in
film.
The 50s, but they've done one film in the 50s, and even still, there's no, they've not been under 50.
One that was 60, and then everything else is like 70, high 70s and above. I just think that's baffling to me. It's like, I feel as though there's some stigma around some filmmakers that as soon as they make something, it's like the best thing ever. And it's like, I don't think it's as cut and dry as that. And I think people will just argue. It's like, I mean, if you're a fan of the Coen Brothers, I mean, you probably like every film, but it would be interesting to hear somebody that's like totally a big fan go, actually, wait a minute, some of these films are a bit naff. But I feel as though they're that well sort of respected and well protected in a weird way, with this kind of sort of shield of they make great films all the time, that I doubt we'll hear a sort of a hot take, maybe as hot a take as we're having about this. And we're not really ones for hot takes, really. It's just we give an opinion. But yeah, I just think it's what is one of these films that, you know, I know that it probably to you doesn't have a cultural impact and legacy, but I think inherently with the names that's attached to it, the Coen Brothers, that there is some form of legacy for the film. That's the thing. Like, I just can't take away my own opinion of that. I just think it's one of those things.
I don't know. That's fair, but I honestly think that I don't think this film has much of an impact compared to other films. I think there's the other Coen Brothers films have, and this one hasn't. I can't see them all at the same level because they aren't all just because the Coen Brothers made it.
Oh well, we agree to disagree. I kind of agree, but I also have my own take. But yeah, that's fine. It was the same in Sex, Lies and Videotape. So
apparently, almost had a possible sequel, which is interesting to know. They had an interest in making one.
Sorry, which has kind of been part of some of the legacy, some of the films that we've done. I mean, if there's a whole chain of films that come after and stuff, then potentially it does have a legacy and it's been impactful enough to get there. But no, I stand by with what I said. I just hate the fact that that's my take, that because it's a Coen Brothers film, it has like a legacy that's kind of there, which
I guess you'll always see it. Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. I'll always see it. Yeah. Like, it's just, I think if this film was made by another filmmaker, I don't like, would we be even talking about it? Possibly not. I've got a take coming up just in the final part of the podcast that explains why I think that.
Okay.
So is that us? Are we done for the rules section?
That is us done.
Anyway, we will now move on to the final part of the podcast, which is where we decide, based on the conversation that we've just had, is it a cult film and does it deserve to be in our top 100 list of cult films? So, do you want to start here or do you want me to go?
I'll go first. I think this film is slightly known, but I don't think it's known very well. I think, judging by like the stuff we've covered in the rules, I think it kind of hits quite a few. I feel this film is a cult film. I think if there was a Coen Brothers film that was going to be a cult film, it's this one from what I've heard. There might be a few others that could be seen as being a bit culty, but I feel like this film has kind of disappeared off the radar a bit. It's known and it has its fans, in fact, loyal fans who think this film's great. Some people, like I said, in the videos I was watching, were saying it was their favourite Coen Brothers film. I don't know how, but like, never mind that. But yeah, so I think it is. It's just, you don't hear much about it, and I think people, it's got a following, And you can see that if you look up. But if you also, if you look up as well, you'll notice that, say if you look up on YouTube for like videos about Barton Fink, you'll find that there's some there, but there's not actually that many there. And they also don't have that many views. It's like, so it shows you that it's there, but it's not like big, I don't think, anyway. Well, at the time, maybe. It did get nominated for awards and stuff like that. It's quite weird. I don't know. I feel like this one's kind of disappeared now more than ever, and I think that's what's making it more of a cult film now. But I would say it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair take. Do you want to place it on where you would put it, or do you just... I feel as though you probably aren't putting it on your list.
Nah, I wouldn't put it on, though. I wouldn't recommend this film really to really anyone, unless they were like, you might like it if you're a Coen Brothers fan. I really didn't like it very much, you know what I mean? I don't know who I would recommend it to.
Fair point. If you're giving it a 2 out of 5, you're probably not recommending it. I mean, who recommends 2 out of 5 movies to people?
Exactly. Unless that's what you're looking for.
Unless you're looking for shite films. I mean, this isn't a shite film, it's just... I think it's one of these, you either like it or you don't. Just off the back of me saying that we don't do hot takes, I've read my notes and I'm like, fucking hell, people are going to, if people listen to the podcast, right, we don't get loads of listens, and I appreciate anybody who does listen because we enjoy doing this. But I feel as though if this podcast ever gets some traction and people listen to this episode, what I'm about to say is probably going to be considered a hot take, and people might flame me for my opinion here. But yeah, based on the whole fact, is it cult? Well, in my opinion, like almost all Coen Brothers films, they are somehow inherently deemed cult films, regardless of fucking how big they are, because they seem to be the most kind of culty movie makers, you know, when you think about them.
What?
That's just the way I feel about it.
Wow, this is one of your first takes where I'm really like, wait, what?
Yeah, it's strange. I just think that they've got that kind of weird inherently everything they make's cult, you know, like, why have they got three films on this poster, you know? Even if they had a box office success, I still think people would argue, well, maybe No Country, maybe not, like, True Grit, maybe not. There's maybe a couple of outliers, but I think there's a lot of films that would qualify or would be brought up for discussion.
Like, I think they make very different films from like a lot of other things.
This is my hot takes are yet to come, by the way.
Oh god, here we go.
A lot of the Coen Brothers films are not made for my personal taste. You know the kind of films that I like. I think they're the most overrated and overly talked about filmmakers of the past 30 plus years.
Wow.
I just think they are. Like, and why? Like, for what reason? because they've put themselves in this kind of weird niche position where they've not done a Damien Chazelle and took a big swing and missed, you know? Do you get what I mean? Like, I feel as like they're in the pocket of themselves all the time, which is nothing wrong with that, but I feel like they've never really deviated out of it. Maybe No Country was like a sort of step out of their comfort zone slightly, but they had dabbled in a Western kind of vibe film before. It's just it got a bit darker with that. This sounds like a hot take, and I'm not saying that they aren't good filmmakers or great filmmakers, but in my opinion, when you stack them up to some of their peers, I just much prefer the films of the other directors. You know, I would take like loads of filmmakers over the last 30 years over the Coen Brothers, and this is off of a take that I had on Instagram where I said that Steven Soderbergh's probably one of the most underrated filmmakers of the last 30 years because nobody fucking talks about him. There's your hot take. How do you think? Do you think that's a hot take?
It's kind of spicy.
It's like probably the hot. I don't think it's the hottest take I've ever had, but I feel like it is a hot take. Think about it logically, right? Their first film, right? Just look at the back catalogue. Like, say inherently, every film they make is cult. But you just look at it, right? So, Blood Simple, probably culty. Raised in Arizona is on this list. Miller's Crossing It's kind of like a weird gangster film that nobody speaks about. Barton Fink, The Hudsucker Proxy, Big Lebowski, Oh Brother Where Art Thou, Burn After Reading, Inside Llewyn Davis. I mean, there's so many films that people would be like, oh, some folk have probably never even heard about.
I think that's true. I think there's some. Do you know what it is with the Coen brothers? This is what I would say about the Coen brothers and about their films. And you, I mean, you and you saying they're overrated is, I don't think you're going to like every Coen brothers film, because Coen brothers films are actually quite different from each other. If you like watch one like this and go to something like Fargo, they're quite different.
Do you think Coen brothers fans like all their films? Well, that's what I prefaced before.
Of course, there will be fans who like all their films. But I think for the Coen brothers, really, I think they've made that different. They do variation of different things, and there's the films that are for you and the films that are for not. So it's like they've done so many different things. Some of them won't be for you. Some of them will be. So you kind of like choose the ones that you like. Like for me, I really like Fargo, and Fargo's probably my favorite Coen brothers film. But I would say the best one is No Country. But I also really like Buster Scruggs. Burn After Reading. Please watch Burn After Reading. Burn After Reading is so good.
Anyway, like we're not deep. Like I know I've just given a hot take where I've just kind of slightly slandered the Coen brothers, and like, by saying that they're overrated and like overly talked about doesn't mean, I'm not saying they're bad filmmakers. That isn't my take. It's just the term overrated still applies. I think it's one of them things. It's just, I feel as though every film that they make just gets this kind of traction regardless, you know? And
I mean, I don't know. I think there's quite a lot of their films I don't know about.
I feel as if there's like a weird tinge to me. Like, how are all of their films that good? Like, I know, it's strange. And I'll deep dive them one day and watch all of them and I'll rank my Coen brothers movies at some point. I mean, but anyway, this is a cult film. Like I said, most Coen brothers films are kind of weirdly cult in their own way. I'm not sure if I'd put it in my top 100 like Kenzie, because I feel as though there is much better films by the Coen brothers on the list even coming up that possibly will make my top 100. And this is where I want to end the podcast. This is my question to all yous listeners. And then please comment on Instagram posts or Twitter posts or wherever you can write a comment, even on Spotify or wherever you get your podcast. Are the Coen brothers the most overrated filmmakers of the past 30 years? It's my question to the audience. I would like to hear your thoughts on that, because I think they are. Kenzie thinks it's a hot take or a spicy take.
Slightly spicy. I think your take of all Coen brothers being a cult film is a hot take.
I've got a couple of spicy takes here.
Yeah, I think that was a bit more hot take than what the other thing you said was. But I would say they're definitely not the most overrated. I don't think so. I just think they make, you know, since they do so the different things, there's films that you'll like and there's films that you're not for a lot of people. Whereas some films, some directors kind of stick to the same kind of thing, almost Tarantino-esque. So you tend to like a lot. If you like that type of film, you end up liking all of their films.
No, this is what I was just about to preface. This is a hot take because I don't like them, or it seems as though I don't like them, so I've got an opinion like this. Whereas if somebody said to you, Tarantino is the most overrated filmmaker of the last 30 years, you'd be like, that's a load of nonsense, because you really like him. And if somebody says to me that Christopher Nolan is the most overrated filmmaker of the last 25 years, I'd be like, that's a load of bullshit, because I really like him. So we would argue against it, but people would probably still have a reasoning to say that Tarantino's overrated and Christopher Nolan's overrated based on sort of critical and sort of the way some people view their filmmaking. And I think that's fine. It's just based on my opinion of the Coen brothers, so that's why I've said that. Not that I think they're like bad filmmakers, it's just I just feel like they get put on a pedestal and spoken about in such a way that I just don't fully understand. And I know that there's people out there listening. And I brought this person up in the last episode, and I'm not sure he still listens to the podcast. I know that he did. But Drew, former lecturer, I know that you're a Coen Brothers fan. This is another one. Please reach out and explain the Coen brothers to me, because I just don't get it. It's something I just don't quite fully understand. There's something there that's kind of intangible for people, the intangible quality, but I think me and Kenzie both just don't quite get it. Specifically on this film, I think, Kenzie, you probably like a lot of Coen Brothers films. I like a few of them as well. It's not like I hate every Coen Brothers movie. But yeah, spicy takes to end the podcast. Have you got any spicy take to end the podcast?
Not at the moment, no. I'm trying to think. I don't know. I just don't like this film. I think everyone who gave this film an 80% needs to think again.
Right, spicy take from Kenzie. Is this a bottom five film that we've watched so far from the list?
It's like out of like all the ones we've watched from the cult.
So out of the 21 films we've watched, would you place this in the bottom five?
Yes, this is one of the worst.
There you go. There's a spicy take for you. Bottom five film out of 20. Fuck's sake, folk are coming at you, Kenzie. They're coming at both of us.
Our
heads will roll.
I want to see all these people who give this high rating and I just got to know, like, what?
Anyway, this is went off on a mad tangent. We should probably wrap up the podcast now. Couple of clips potentially coming from here. This is quite good. I'll maybe just leave them in because people probably want to hear spicy takes and people go off on mad rants. I suppose that's what podcasts are all about. But yeah, if you've fuck's sake, I've lost it. If you've enjoyed listening to this episode and would like to check out past episodes of the podcast, you can do so by searching for Cult Film Cafe wherever you get your podcast, and you can go over and give us a wee follow on both the old Instagram and the Twitter at Cult Film Cafe. That would be much appreciated. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Everything is linked in the bio on Instagram, and if you're struggling to find us, just Google search us. We will pop up. We have a unique Google search. Don't know why that's happened, but it has. So yeah, this has been an interesting one. Some spicy takes. I hope you've enjoyed, and it's a goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from me.
Podcast out.
Like Barton Fink, by the end of this episode, I think we've went insane.